Okay, it's Thursday, September the 3rd, 2015, and this is the Radio Free Northwest call-in show, and we are now waiting for our first callers. And in the meantime, I guess Don and I can shoot breeze about general political events, etc., etc.
All right, and America's favorite topic, Donald Trump continues to actually rise a little more in the polls, and it's clear that he is going to be the one to beat. He's still continuing to do well, and I don't think there's a chance in hell that the people who control the Republican Party are going to let him be their candidate.
Today he took the official loyalty oath or whatever. I'm not quite sure exactly what that comprises because I didn't read the whole article on Drudge, but apparently the Republican establishment in South Carolina had made it some kind of condition before they would even put him on the ballot that he had to agree not to run as a third-party candidate. And I can understand why the Republicans are upset by that prospect, because if he did, he would pull enough white votes away to just completely throw the election to the Democrats, like basically Ross Perot did in 1992. But he did comply, and he took the blood oath, or whatever it is they required of him. And so now they don't have any excuse to come at him from that angle.
Well, they don't have to. All they have to do is have a backroom deal at the convention, and it doesn't matter a bit how the people who attend the convention vote.
I can't remember any time in the recent past when these nominations were actually decided at the convention anyway. Frankly, my observation over the past few elections is that Iowa and New Hampshire pretty much does it, because at that point you can tell who the establishment has decided that their candidate is going to be, and it's really kind of hard to catch up from that. We've got this peculiar situation where the actual nominations are usually decided in the first few months of the primaries, mostly by those two, Iowa and New Hampshire. Super Tuesday is all very spectacular, but generally speaking, we have a pretty good idea how it's going to come out. The actual election itself, I'm still kind of halfway convinced that at some point the two parties arrived at a agreement or gentleman's agreement or whatever that they would switch over every 8 years in the White House. And in order to keep that 8-year time frame going, they deliberately put up in a second term election the worst doofus that they can possibly find. I mean, look at the Republican candidates in 96, which was Bob Dole, Mr. Baker the Undertaker. And in 2000, it was Al Gore, Mr. Personality. I swear to God, I think he was a palooka set up to lose, even if the left wing of the Democratic Party couldn't quite grasp it, and they bitched and moaned about Florida and hanging chads and all that sort of stuff. And then in 2004, they put up John Kerry, who is just the ultimate political mediocrity of the century, just about. And in 2008, when it was the Republicans' turn to lose, they put up Grandpa Simpson himself, John McCain, who is probably the most utterly, completely unpopular Republican. And then in 2012, when again they were set to lose, they put up a Mormon, which completely, totally wiped out their Christian fundamentalist base, because most Christian fundamentalists, 700 clubs types, consider Mormonism to be a cult.
The Mormons just don't seem to fit in with the rest of Christianity in the United States.
Well, maybe this is going to be one of those weeks when nobody decides to call in, except the one guy who called in 2 hours early. Okay, here we go. Where's the cursor? You're on Radio Free Northwest. Who am I speaking with, please?
Jesse from Mississippi.
I believe you were on last week, Jesse.
Yes, sir.
Well, how's things going down there in the Magnolia State?
I don't know. I'm up in Illinois right now.
How'd you end up in Illinois?
Driving a truck.
The general subject this week again will be prepping and survivalism, etc., since we weren't able to get any of you callers on last week. You are recording fine here right now. I can see your squiggles on the little graph here, so you are recording.
All right.
Yes, we fixed your technical problem.
Technology is wonderful.
Anything you wanted to say on the subject of survivalism or prepping or anything else?
Basically, just what was said last week, it comes down to the nuts and bolts of what you do. It doesn't really matter. It's just a matter of forming a group. one person can go out and live in the woods by themselves, but they're not really accomplishing anything.
You're also not necessarily going to survive if a gang finds you wherever you happen to be in the woods.
Yeah.
That's one aspect of this whole idea of running out in the woods and hiding in a cabin and all that sort of stuff. When the balloon goes up, one of the many phenomena that are going to be associated with that is massive, almost waves, human waves of non-whites spilling out of the cities once the food and the water and the general supplies run out and the electricity goes down for the last time. They're going to be kind of stuck there in those concrete canyons, and they're going to start moving out into the countryside just to look for food, water, whatever is left of the goodies of America. They'll be like massive swarms of locusts radiating outward from the cities, and eventually they're going to reach almost any rural area where you care to go and hide and hole up. And so in the long run, getting a cabin in the woods or digging a hole and pulling it after you, it's just not going to be a viable solution.
Especially in the east, there's so many cities and so many people.
That's one good thing about the West Coast. Although we do have some megalopoli out here on the West Coast, notably Los Angeles, San Francisco, then you go on up and you get some population areas, but the next really big city up the coast is Portland, and then there's the Pugetopolis here, but both Portland and the Pugetopolis aren't quite as infested, at least not as yet, with niggers and Mexicans as all this huge area of big cities in the Midwest and in the New England especially.
Oh, and the East Coast, like Baltimore, Washington, oh, that's hugely nigger. And then, of course, you go down south farther into Dixie.
We got somebody else calling in here. You're on Radio Free Northwest. Who am I speaking with?
It's Richard from Virginia.
Oh, okay. Let's see if we can get you into the call here. There we go. Okay, we got you both on. We got Richard in Virginia and Jesse in Mississippi.
Ah, good.
And you guys are recording because I can see your little squiggles, like I say, on the Audacity graph here. So,
got your technical problem straightened out. That's great.
Looks like. Okay. Yeah. The suggested subject again this week is survivalism and prepping because basically the audience wasn't able to hear you guys last week. So anything you have to say on that subject, lay it on us.
When I hear the word survival, I go, in what frame of reference? Is it surviving if you're in the Northwest, or is it survival if you're not in the Northwest yet? Mm-hmm. It's like two different scenarios. It seems like, to me, if I have to survive and I'm not in the Northwest where there are like-minded people, I have to run my life a little bit differently because I have to keep a low profile, number one. I don't want to cause any alarm bells to go off. That's going to cause me more grief. If I'm in the Northwest, my sense of surviving out there would be as independent as possible. In other words, I guess in both instances, in my mind, would be to opt out of the system, get off the grid, be as independent as possible, because then you're not dependent upon anybody so much, and you have control of your own life. I think that's the problem now we have, is that our life is...
All right, we've got somebody else calling in. Hang on just a minute, Richard. You're on Radio Free Northwest. Who am I speaking with, please?
Hello, this is Terry in Florida, Harold.
And we now have all three of you. We got Terry from Florida who just came in.
Terry.
As I said in the email, Terry, anything you want to say now about survivalism, prepping, etc., go ahead and lay this on us again, since the audience basically wasn't able to hear you guys last week.
Okay, well, very, very good. The approach that I have taken to survival and prepping and whatnot is a little different than what a lot of people have done. I believe that your greatest survival skill exists between your ears. And I think that any time you make a big pile of whatever, you not only make a big pile of stuff that you can use, but other people can use too and be targeted. So the path that my wife and I have taken over the course of years, way before we ever got involved in any white nationalist issues, is our microenvironment and how to survive on what we have. We have, over the course of years, made a study of wild plants and wild foods and medicines that are useful that grow in our immediate vicinity. And as rich as the environment in the Northwest is, any of the compatriots out there that want to get into this kind of research will have a rich field to delve into. We have discovered down here in North Florida 86 different varieties of plants that are good for either medicine, fiber, or food. One of the things I want to caution people about is when you see a plant and your field guide is edible, don't necessarily confuse edible with delectable.
Right.
they're not always the same thing. The fact of the matter is, it's been a very rewarding study. We've enjoyed it quite a lot and have enjoyed from time to time springing wild foods on our guests when they come over for dinner.
One thing we were saying earlier, Terry, the West Coast actually has fewer of these big, huge cities, and when the balloon does go up, what you're going to be getting is basically these human waves of black and brown scum, and we got another one coming in. You're on Radio Free Northwest. Who am I speaking with?
Hi, it's Adam from New Jersey again.
Okay, we got four of them now. Adam in New Jersey. Adam, before you called, Terry was talking about some of the prepping and survival stuff that he's been doing in North Florida, identifying edible plants, that sort of stuff. The one thing I was going to say to Terry is that when the balloon does go up, we're going to get these massive migrations of black and brown scum out of the cities who are going to start moving across the countryside like locusts, devouring every available resource, and eventually they're going to get to wherever most people are hiding. Now, Terry, in your particular location, I know you're a southerner and you like the area you're in and so forth, and I know you've made a study of the flora and fauna down there in Florida, etc., but when the balloon does go up, there are going to be some parts of the North American continent that are worse than others, and my personal opinion is that just about anywhere in Florida is not going to be a very good place to be, because you are actually sort of surrounded by these huge metropolitan areas and huge non-white areas. Like, I gather just about everything in Florida south of Tallahassee now is in essence part of the third world. You're going to be right within range of all the migrations or hordes of non-whites that are going to come pouring out of Miami and St. Pete, Atlanta. To the west, you got Mobile and some of those other urban areas. Birmingham, very niggerized areas. You're in the south. So basically, you're going to have niggers coming down from the north, and you're going to have various Hispanic whatchamadoodles coming up from South Florida. So I think regardless of what kind of preparations you were able to make, anything or any attempt for white people or any white communities to survive in Florida is going to be pretty rough, because basically this is one of the parts of the continent where we are essentially outnumbered. You're going to be surrounded down there, and I hope that you and your wife will at some point be able to start making some serious plans for your Northwest migration, because when it does hit the fan, in my personal opinion, Florida is not a good place to be.
Well, you're certainly correct on that, especially in the area that we happen to be in. The county that we reside in is about 63% black. The immediate area that we're in is almost entirely white, and it is a secluded community. We have all networked. We have several boots we can get in the dirt, but we are all very well aware that it's not viable over the long run.
Yeah.
We studied firing positions and setups and whatnot, and I won't go into names and details, but we know that we have some survivability for the interim, but not for the long term. That is why that I'm encouraging people and have given any number of sets of your books to different people to encourage them to move to the Northwest. One of the issues that we face is what a lot of people face. Here I am, 60 years old, and I have an elderly mother that I'm partially responsible for, so it makes immediate moving to the Northwest very, very difficult. We're aware of the situation. We're aware of our exposure and danger. That's why we do what we can to mitigate it in the immediate area, but plan on the future.
Yeah.
I'm in the position that I have quite a bit of knowledge in specific areas, but I'm also able to count.
There's a lot of places like that all across North America, what you might call white pockets, here, there, and everywhere, much more so as you get out towards the Midwest. For example, they now figure that the majority of public school children in Des Moines, Iowa, are going to be non-white minorities next year, but including a number of non-English speaking minorities. But the fact is that Iowa itself, as the state, is still very largely white. When they move these wogs and these Muncoids in there from Somalia or wherever, they do tend to congregate naturally in the cities. Well, that's just a non-white thing. That's especially a black thing. There are sections of North Carolina right now that are actually, in theory, whiter than they were under the 1900 census, because all the blacks have moved out to go to Durham or Charlotte or someplace and live in the projects and draw welfare. Of course, the problem in rural North Carolina and throughout most of the rural South is they are awash in Mexicans, and there is no accurate count of how many Hispanics and other strange third world wogs are in the South right now, because they're as yet all illegal, and there's never been any real effort made to quantify their numbers. But I recommend to anybody who is living essentially east of the Mississippi, at the very least, you need, if nothing else, to get west of the Mississippi, where there's some space between communities and whatnot, because when those mobs of millions of non-whites come roiling out of the cities, starving and out for blood, and all law and order has broken down, which is a situation I didn't used to be too really worried about, but now appears to me to be a very likely situation. You don't want to be white men surrounded by a black sea.
I have a comment on that, Harold. What Terry said is correct in what you said. I have a home in Florida. It's right around Sarasota area, and it's primarily white. But I'm often amazed while traveling up 75, and I travel up 75 through Georgia and through South Carolina on 26. When you get off the main highway, you wouldn't believe how many areas are awash with niggers and Mexicans. You don't realize it when you travel in the interstate. And I had an epiphany one time on 26. There was a block on 26. 26 goes from 95, which is on the coast, and travels through South Carolina. And I took a road that was, I can't remember the route number, but it was parallel to 26, so I avoid all the congestion. And I go through a town. One of the towns was Orangeburg, South Carolina. Harold, I was in a foreign country. All the faces were black. I didn't have my GPS with me. When I stopped and asked for directions or to get gas, I got a lot of cold, hard stares. They didn't want me there. So this is my own country. But you don't realize how widespread it is until you start moving off the interstates and traveling off the beaten path, so to speak.
Well, this is one of the reasons that I am no longer operating as a Southern Nationalist. In the late 80s and early 90s, I went through a Southern Nationalist phase. I wrote a pamphlet called The South Shall Rise Again, and so forth and so on. And every now and then somebody that remembers that will ask me, say, well, Harold, how come you ain't a Southern Nationalist no more? And it's because I came to realize that, as bitter as it was to me being a Southerner, the fact is the South is gone. There are simply too many non-whites there, and they could not be relocated or moved out without military force of such a massive level that we just realistically are not going to command it. So that's why I came to the conclusion that the only remaining solution was the establishment of a sovereign nation in the Pacific Northwest. The demographics here, I have to admit, are getting worse, and that's another reason we need to get on the stick and we need to get this moving, but I think events are catching up with us. It's very hard for me to explain why I feel like this, because bear in mind I've got about 50 years of reading and studying history and feeling political situations in places like Ireland and Africa and that sort of stuff, but to me, from what I see just on Drudge Report and the internet and bits and pieces of news that I pick up, this society is going into a terminal phase, because things are getting so just plain screwed up that at some point something is going to snap or break. I don't know if some of you caught an article last week. There was a glitch of some kind in the EBT system. I presume they've got it fixed, because it's now September the 3rd and there's no nigger rioting. But for a couple of days there, apparently the EBT computer system broke down and the various recipients among the 95 million unemployed could not use their EBT cards. And at some point, something has got to give here. The United States has survived decades longer than I ever thought it could, because it just seems to have this incredible resiliency, and it is still an incredibly wealthy country and an incredibly wealthy society. Our white population is still, all in all, very, very productive. But what's happening here is something similar to what we have seen in South Africa for the past 20 years. When the Kaffirs finally took over in South Africa, everything didn't immediately break down and go completely haywire. So everyone says, ha, 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 see, blacks can rule a technological society. Well, no, they can't. Also, the ANC had sufficient sense to realize that they needed to keep technically skilled whites to keep the modern technological society running. But after 20 years, their own corruption, their own Kaffir stupidity, is finally starting to destroy South Africa. The power doesn't work there half the time. The crime is now at a level of just guerrilla racial warfare, and the white population has actually been reduced by almost half what it was 20 years ago because a lot of people, even the Afrikaners, are simply fleeing. It's happening here. I think we can get a good lesson as to what's going to happen in this country by looking at what's happened to South Africa under the ANC since the end of apartheid. Okay, Adam, what have you got? We were talking about survivalism and prepping and whatnot since the audience wasn't able to hear you guys last week.
As far as how prepared I am in New Jersey for survivalism, or if shit hits the fan, essentially. As you were saying about our friend in North Florida, I'm in essentially a very similar situation in South Jersey, surrounded by Atlantic City, Camden, Philadelphia, Newark. Just about any direction you turn, it's not really a good story, but I don't plan to be here for much longer myself. As far as if there was any kind of natural disaster, power goes out. I know a fair bit about camping, basic survivalism. I wouldn't call myself an expert, but I'd be better off than most, I'd say. I keep a good supply of fresh water, flashlight, all your basic stuff, good bit of extra gas.
Adam, I was from New Jersey and Camden. Can you enlighten us? I know Camden is a real basket case. How bad it is in Camden? I hear all kinds of horror stories.
It was once the murder capital of the U.S. I don't think it holds that distinction anymore, but just
probably
walking
Baltimore
through.
Baltimore does now.
At night, if you don't want to stop at traffic lights, you just kind of want to slow down, take a look both ways, and then get it on. Carjackings are really common. The city, it physically smells when you walk through it. From what I don't know, but wherever you are, it kind of permeates. It essentially looks a lot like those pictures of Detroit you'll find where there's boarded up houses, barbed wire on them, that looks like they might have once been nice houses in the 40s or 50s or so. Essentially, it's Detroit on a smaller scale.
Well, Detroit is shrinking, so maybe Camden will be the big one soon.
Yeah. Detroit is actually getting depopulated. A lot of the reasons you have blocks and blocks and blocks of empty, boarded up, trashed out houses in Detroit is because there's just not any people there. Both whites and blacks are leaving because there's nothing there for them. Apparently, even the blacks who live on welfare are having a hard time now in Detroit because nothing works. There's no money for anything. All the shopping facilities and all the infrastructure has closed down. Put it this way, Detroit is becoming so bad that even niggers don't want to live there anymore.
I think that's like a progression. You've got Camden, you've got Detroit, but there's going to be other cities as time goes on. They're going to turn bad. Once you reach a critical point, things are just going to accelerate exponentially. And when the EBT cards break down, when the trucks won't make deliveries to the inner cities, that's when they're going to start migrating out of the cities and looking for an easy target. I think that's what we're looking forward to, the way things are going. Then the economy, too. After a while, the money is going to be worthless. What I said before about getting off the grid, being as independent as possible. Another point is when the government clamps down on an area, and I think this is what the military does. They control the electricity, they control the water. They'll turn it off and on at will. That'll be their discipline to keep us in line.
Another one that you probably haven't thought of, but is actually being used these days, is to interrupt communications. In particular, the first thing they'll do is jam the cell phone coverage in areas that they're concerned about.
That's right.
They've already done that in San Francisco and I think other places, but this is clearly now a standard practice.
I wonder how strong the grade of signal jamming is, because I know you can buy boosters yourself. Maybe you could even jury-rig ones to be stronger.
That would work fine if you were using something other than the cell phone system, because all they have to do is jam the towers. Maybe you can get a signal out, but how are you going to get a signal in? The cell phone system is the easiest thing to jam on a local basis, and that's what they've done first.
You're right, Don. The military does have frequency generators that'll jam all cell phone communications in a certain area. And matter of fact, you can buy them for yourself to put in a business or a house, and you can even find them that you can put them in your car.
Yes, and they've been used in movie theaters to prevent people from disturbing the rest of the people watching a movie.
That's correct.
Somebody was making a point that I wanted to clarify, and that is that there is more than one type of disaster that you might want to prepare for. There are the short-lived things like earthquakes or tornadoes or hurricanes or some other natural disaster where you have to prepare for a week to a month or so. And those things are relatively easy to prepare for. Economic collapse, which is longer lasting, is more difficult. And that is something that I like to emphasize, since it looks like we're approaching that in the not too distant future. And for that, my little repetitive message here is that you want to be part of a group. If you're part of a group, your survival chances are very good. If you're not part of a group, your survival chances are very poor.
If you want to see an example of the kind of thing that America will be facing when, as we say, the balloon goes up, they're starting to get this right now in Europe with all these so-called migrants that are just literally, I don't know, it's like somebody flipped a switch or somebody organized it all from behind the scenes, which maybe they did. But all of a sudden, we've got these waves and waves and waves of so-called migrants, mostly coming from the Middle East, but also from Africa, just storming the barricades of Europe. The Hungarians put up a fence, and the niggers and the wogs just cut through it. They're taking over trains now. They've apparently made the tunnel exit or entrance on the Calais side in France virtually unusable. There are apparently hundreds of thousands of them now. This is literally the camp of the saints, as they are storming into Europe, demanding. They're demanding to be given all the welfare benefits, but they refuse to be, quote-unquote, put in camps. And it's incredible. And of course, the governments of Europe are just sort of sitting there staring like a deer in the headlights. So far as I know, they're just arguing among themselves about who will take how many of these wogs. And the very idea of forcing these third worlders back where they came just simply hasn't even been mentioned. It's so unspeakable. So it looks like they're going to be allowed to stay, which of course is one of the reasons they're coming there. This is giving us a glimpse of the kind of thing that we can expect. I remember last summer or last year, we had all of a sudden this massive wave of so-called children coming across the border unaccompanied. It's like somebody's setting this up. I hate to kind of get down into paranoid conspiracy theory here, but this is very strange that all of a sudden these things are occurring. If I had to guess, I'd utter the name of George Soros, who seems to be kind of the evil eminence behind a lot of the garbage that's been going on in the past 10 years.
In my world, sure it's organized. It's a no-brainer for me. How do you get all these people together and get them on trains and bring them in here and get the publicity and the media coverage? Well, sure it's organized.
A lot of the ways they have gotten there has costed quite a bit of money that they surely wouldn't have had.
I kind of feel that a lot of the world that we live in is fantasy. It's constructed to keep us fearful. It's to keep us disorganized. Here's an instance, the shooting in Virginia. I caught myself in this. That's where the reporter and the cameraman were shot by this black guy that was fired. When I first heard it, I'm thinking, gee, that's really awful. The poor people just doing their job and they got shot. And I kind of bought into it. And a little while later, I thought about it a little bit. I said, wait a minute. This is some kind of a setup. We'll need to find out. It's starting to come out now. The whole thing's a fake. You just look at what's going on. Maybe it's a conspiracy. Maybe it isn't. But I can't believe any of it. I'm living in fantasy land if I pay attention to all this.
It's turned out that that nigger was a former gay prostitute. And they showed pictures of him dancing around more or less naked with a cowboy hat on. Part of his problem, he was apparently texting back and forth with his quote-unquote friend, whom I assume was another nigger or another faggot. He was lamenting his loss of his glory days when he was young and he was living high on the hog, peddling his chocolate-covered ass to rich homosexuals or whatever. It's just, it's insane. I mean, only in America.
My point is, he kind of off balance. That's what I like about the new Northwest Front. It gives you a basis, some kind of a base to move forward from. To plan your life, be it a big move or little baby steps, but at least you're working towards something. It fits in with my genetic makeup and gives me an identity. In this world out here, the world of radio, TV, and the media, and football, and all that, I don't even know who the hell I am if I pay attention to that. But at least the Northwest Front, and you do have a plan, it gives us an identity, something to shoot for, something to work towards. I think your organization is great. I really do.
It's not an organization quite yet, but it does give a workable alternative. I've said this time and time and time again, and I'm going to say it again. The difference between us and every other white nationalist organization movement, well, there are no more organizations, but the difference between us and other white nationalists is that we have a plan. It may be a good plan. It may be a bad plan in your opinion. You may have questions about it, but it is a plan, and nobody else has even that much. What are these other outfits, which mostly consist of websites, planning on doing to actually change things? If you really look at it, their solution is to just keep on tap, 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 tapping on your computer keyboard, and maybe once a year, once every 13, 14 months, they get together in a rented motel banquet room and yak, 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 and that's not going to bring about change. We've got a plan. It's a hard plan. We're having a lot of difficulty getting white people to wrap their minds around it, and it's not going to be easy, and it ain't going to be no bed of roses, but at least we have a progressive strategy. The first step is forming communities here in the Northwest in a geographically and demographically manageable area, so we don't have this huge continent full of scum that we have to somehow cleanse, which is just simply not possible. So that's the first step. That's the step we're working on right now. And nobody else has even that much. I don't think I'm being melodramatic when I say that the Northwest Front is literally the last hope of the white race. What I can foresee is that all these Europeans, whose countries are now being completely overrun by all these human waves of wogs, it's going to be like in the Bronze Age or whatever, when these constant migrations of people had a domino effect and they would push the previous inhabitants of the land they were migrating into, and they'd pack up their ox wagons and they'd start migrating. So you had these great movements all across Europe of Franks and Teutons and Avars and Scythians and whatnot. Okay, anyway, we got another caller coming in. You're on Radio Free Northwest. Who am I speaking with?
This is Andrew from Arizona.
And we now have five callers. Our new arrival is Andrew from Arizona. How's it going down there in the desert with the scorpions and armadillos and all, Andrew?
It's finally starting to cool down. It's only been 108 today.
Okay. Autumn is coming. There's a little nip in the air. We are once again getting into the area of prepping, survivalism, etc., because basically the audience couldn't hear you guys last week, so anything you have to say on the subject, lay it on us.
I have a quick question, actually. In our last call-in, I think it was you who mentioned that it's not necessarily how much food you have stored or how much weapons you have stored. It's a community you have to latch onto that keeps you alive, that helps you survive. The group is a big part of surviving.
Amen, brother.
So I have a quick question, and this is purely a hypothetical. Now, I think that everyone either agrees or has some kind of idea, doomsday prophecy of when at the fan. Oh, let's just say hypothetically that it does. Does the Northwest Front have any sort of plan for, let's just say, refugees coming to come land, or is that kind of a back burner?
In my own mind, yeah, I have an idea of some of the things we could do. The problem is we don't have anything to do it with. I probably am going to be more and more going into Jim Baker mode as the months go on, but the simple fact is we are almost totally devoid of resources, and we are taking our first few baby steps right now. You guys, I think, probably would not be aware of this, but for a long time, almost 20 years, I myself was legally debilitated in a way that I am forbidden to get into, but that situation no longer applies. So since basically December of last year, I have been doing everything I can to catch up and build the kind of infrastructure and whatnot that I should have been building for the past 20 years. We are starting slowly, 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 glacially slowly to do this. We are moving so slow because we lack two things. We lack bodies, boots on the ground, and we lack money. That idea of dealing with a refugee situation has occurred to me. I know what should be done. Right now, if I were to get into a long speech on that, I would simply be building castles in the air because it can't be done because we simply don't have the money. And we need to concentrate, I think, on what we can do in the short term, because right now that's all we can do. I, in a way, hope that the system lasts long enough so that we can get ready. One of the things that scares me pea green is the fear that all of a sudden I'll wake up tomorrow morning and this is it. The balloon has gone up. Nothing works. The internet's down, so I can't communicate with my own people. And it's just going to be one big, huge, chaotic mess, and we are simply not going to be ready. We're not going to be in any kind of position to take advantage of the situation. That worries me. So in a strange sort of way, I'm kind of praying for the system to last a little bit longer so we will have at least a little bit of time to hopefully get our act together. Of course, I've been trying to get people to do that for the past 40 years. So I don't know. You just do what you can. In Freedom Sons, I think it was chapter 5, I wrote what is probably, in a way, the most important chapter or section of any of my books. It's about a working man in Chicago named Eli Horakova, who has a real bad day. This is just after the Northwest has become free. It's like maybe 8 months afterwards, something like that. And he comes home, and number one, he's lost his job. Number two, he finds a dead nigger lying in his living room because nigger came in and tried to take his 13-year-old daughter away and the 16-year-old son shot him. And all of a sudden, that's it. This guy who's been battling this system all his life and been crapped on and crapped down, all of a sudden, this is it. There's no more escape. There's no more evasion. This man and his family have just come face to face with race, the truth, the reality. The real-world crisis of race, because he's got a dead nigger there. He's got to explain, and he's got a white skin, and his son's got a white skin, and in the America, at that time, President Chelsea Clinton, there is no way that they can get out of that. That's it. They're doomed. They're the wrong color. They were in the wrong place at the wrong time, and they are no longer part of the protected circle of society. America is no longer their country. They just drew the short straw that all white people are terrified of drawing. This happens to white families every day in one form or another. All of a sudden, something happens, and they can no longer evade the whole issue of race and the truth of race. And so what this family have to do is what millions of white families at one point or other are going to have to do in the coming years. They have to flee to the Northwest with literally the shirts on their backs and, you know, what money they've got in their piggy banks and everything they can pile into a battered old van, and that's it. We are going to see this happening time and time and time again, and it may not be as part of the future when we're an established country. It could well be that something's going to happen, and a lot of it will be organic. It could be that maybe we in the Northwest Front will somehow fail to get our act together, or we'll still be floundering around up here begging for $10 and $20 donations when the balloon goes up. But the word is, I think, kind of out in the white population in this country, and not so much to do with us, it's just by osmosis, I guess. Most white people have this vague idea that there is a better, whiter place in the Northwest, and when things do collapse, they're all going to start coming here. We get this already with what we call organic migration. There are migrants coming into the Northwest every day, and they're pretty much racial migrants. They're coming for all the right reasons, it's just they won't admit it.
I've actually had quite a few friends come to me and mention such things, saying that America just isn't what it used to be, so to speak, for what they're seeing happen, what they see going to happen. And over time, I've kind of helped them along the way, saying, oh, well, look at this, or how about this? Why don't you read more about this? I've actually got three friends reading through the white book right now, and so far I've been getting positive reaction from it. They're still a little bit hesitant with the idea of picking up and moving and forming a all-white nation, but at the same time, they don't deny that this is a good idea, that there's something to this.
Andrew, as things get worse down there in Arizona, it's going to look like a better and better idea all the time. I think that's going to be the case with a lot of people. They hear about the idea of a free white nation in the Northwest, and they say, well, it's mildly interesting, but of course it's totally impractical, and I can't be bothered to move, and I got all these commitments here, and so forth and so on.
And I have lots of time before the fan.
And all of a sudden, but as things get worse and worse and worse, the Northwest is going to start looking better and better, and it should, because this is one of the few places, even though we are deteriorating in places like Seattle and Portland, this is one of the few places where you can still find some of the old America left. If you have a trade or a skill or you've got a lot of money and you can afford to go to, say, one of the smaller towns here in the homeland, if you're not forced into the Pugetopolis or Portland or someplace like that because you got to get a job, if you can do that, then this is one of the few places left in the country where you can find little bits and pieces of the old America left.
When I came up here, and I'm 67, this was like a blast from the past for me. It was like living in the 50s and 60s again, with all the white people and the safe environment. People were not paranoid about crime, things like that. Very gun-friendly, like it was, most of America was in the 50s and 60s. The whole ambiance up here is so pleasant compared to what exists in most other places in the United States. Again, it was a blast from the past for me, and I really enjoyed it, and I continue to enjoy it.
Well, like I say, I'm going to be 62 next week, is it? One, 11 days. And I remember what the old ways were like, and yeah, it's very different. The last really heavy-duty place I lived was Texas, and I was living in a place called College Station in Bryan, which is the home of Texas A&M University. And so being a university town, it was a lot whiter than large parts of Texas. One of the things that kind of really convinced me, if I'd needed convincing, was I noticed that when I'd be in a grocery store or a Walmart or any kind of commercial setting like that, I would go up to the checkout counter and the little girl behind the cash register or the guy or whoever could have been a white American just like me, and yet as a matter of store policy apparently, he or she would greet me in Spanish first. And it was that bad. And this was in a college town. And there are counties right now along the Rio Grande in Texas where Spanish has replaced English in the law courts in the sense that they will now accept legal pleadings and depositions and lawsuits and whatever legal forms in Spanish as well as English. I noticed Jeb Bush got jumped on for actually attacking Donald Trump in Spanish. I'm amazed, frankly, that none of our politicians have gone completely Hispanic yet, and they're not doing ads. Well, I think they do ads in Spanish, but effectively speaking, we're becoming a bilingual country. Not just that, but a unilingual country. I've been told by guys from Florida that if you live south of, say, St. Pete or Orlando, you can't really get a job if you don't speak Spanish because, or at least not in any kind of retail setting or anything like that, because you have to deal with Spanish customers who don't speak English.
Right, like here, if you have to speak Spanish, if you have somebody to work with who does speak Spanish.
Anyway, I forget what all we were rambling about, but before Andrew came on, I was saying that this massive migration in Europe might actually end up pushing more and more white Europeans out. We have a very large listenership for RFN in Europe, and as I've said before, these Europeans get it in a way that Americans don't, and I think one of the reasons we're going to need to establish some kind of white homeland here in North America is, if nothing else, to take the fleeing white populations of Europe, because they apparently have no intention of using any kind of force to force those waves of people who are completely unassimilable back to where they came from. About the only thing they're going to be able to do is maybe house them in big camps and feed them and take care of them forever, kind of like they were Palestinians. Some of them may be Palestinians. But the idea of actually forcibly returning them whence they came just simply doesn't even pop up as part of the discussion over there. It's just assumed that virtually anybody with a dark skin has the automatic right to walk into any country in Europe. This is especially ironic because I remember all the problems I had with immigration in the UK. They actually came looking for me. I was, you know, not a long story, but if you're American and if you're white, they're looking for an excuse to come and throw you on the plane. Okay, any political subjects, anything else you guys want to talk about?
I'd like to make a point. You know, Jeb Bush speaking in Spanish and dissing Donald Trump. You know, I just have this picture in my head. Suppose Jeb Bush wins. And he's president of the United States. When he's standing up there on the dais with Columba, and Donald Trump standing up there, if he wins with his wife, I tell you, their taste in women is like 180 degrees. Trump should win just for that alone, for God's sake.
We'll have the best-looking first lady since Jackie Kennedy.
Yeah.
Exactly. The media, they keep pushing Hillary Clinton, they keep pushing Jeb Bush, and I think it's a losing proposition, but they never stop
talking. That was the intention. I was speaking earlier about this idea I've had for a long time, that there is some kind of agreement between the parties about shifting presidents every 8 years or something like this, but I think the intention originally was to have Hillary versus Jeb. Now, I don't know whether Hillary is in on the 8-year deal, and if that's true, it would be her turn to lose, being a Democrat. I'm not quite sure she would go for that. And that could be one of the reasons that the Democrats are so desperately trying to get her out of the race, is because she's not in on the deal, she's not in on the fix, and she doesn't know she's supposed to lose this time around. Then again, I think there's a very powerful faction in the Democratic Party that doesn't want Hillary Clinton to become president under any circumstances. I think the sudden appearance of Barack Obama was, well, of course, that also could have been part of the deal right there. I don't know. But I think a very good case can be made that it is the Obamas and the Democrats who are backed presumably by George Soros who are causing this email thing to continue and continue. You know darn well that if the powers that be didn't want this email scandal to continue, it wouldn't. More and more, I think some of the pundit class as well is coming to the conclusion that this whole thing is an effort to strong-arm Hillary out of the race.
It's almost like it's a script they're following. That's why I say it makes my point. Nothing's real. It's all contrived, and everybody believes it, and that's why we're stuck. We're off balance.
Well,
can't find our way.
Well, it could be. Now, I'm willing to accept the possibility that Trump is a genuine wild card because the man does have an immense ego, and he strikes me as just the type of overgrown Animal House-type frat boy who would love to get into a situation like this and just kick over the table and act like a bull in the china shop and just make a shambles just for the sheer pleasure of it. Very Irish characteristic there. But it could be that he is a for real wild card. And right now, the two parties are looking at a genuine nightmare. They've got two people who are front runners who may end up facing each other off for the presidency, Hillary and Trump, both of whom are uncontrollable by the system. Trump because of his ego, and Hillary because of her insane ambition and her hatred for men. We tend to think of the system and the establishment as all-powerful, as omnipotent and omniscient and all-seeing, all-knowing, and they're all the little men behind the curtain, they're pulling the strings, and that's, I've talked about this before when I was talking about conspiracy theory. I don't think that's a very productive viewpoint, because if we do accept that everything is controlled and that everything is manipulated from behind the scenes and we genuinely have no choice and these people are all powerful, they're eternal, they can never be stopped, then what's the point of any of it? And I just refuse to believe that there is no hope. Any power structure is going to be riddled with intrigue, factionalism, a lot of good, honest hatred. And it is possible that both Hillary and Trump are genuine wild cards in the sense that they are not in control by the Sanhedrin or whoever these big picture people are. And that may be one reason why both of them are driving their respective parties nuts, is because they're not supposed to be there. They're not supposed to be where they are. Apparently, for all her email thing, Hillary Clinton is still ahead in the Democratic polls. She's losing ground. Again, it's hard to determine how much of this stuff is real and how much of it isn't. I'm sure a good deal of it is smoke and mirrors.
Well, that's
I'm sure there's also an element of just randomness in there because human events are not really that controllable.
I just don't buy into it. I don't buy into the system. I put my energies, my mental energies, other places. What goes on, what they've constructed or however they're doing this scenario that they're setting up for the people to believe in, which is where their strength comes from, believe it or not, is what the people believe. If you get enough people believing it, you've got resources, you've got energies you can use. So I just opt out of the system. I focus on getting my life as independent as possible to get away from all that stuff.
And one of the first steps you can take when you do that is to stop watching television. I literally threw mine in a dumpster.
It's just entertainment.
Reality.
That's right. That's right. So you got to watch who's controlling your perceptions. You get disconnected from the real world. That's why I say people don't know who they really are, what you're here for. It's not to work part-time jobs so you can go to Disneyland. You're working to secure yourself and to be as free as possible.
Back on the migration thing, Harold, do you really think that we'll be getting many people from Europe coming to America, or will they all, because of geography, wind up going to Russia?
We have had Europeans try to migrate before. We do have European comrades here. They didn't actually come as migrants. They came to work in various industries and have jobs here. We had one gentleman from Sweden who actually came and visited, and he made a genuine, honest-to-God effort to try and find some kind of job here. The trouble is, what he was in Sweden was a government bureaucrat in a socialist welfare state. He was an office worker. And over here, those are dime a dozen, and His career in Europe just was not something that could prepare him for being economically competitive on the American labor market. Hell, nothing in a socialist welfare state is really going to prepare you to be competitive on any kind of free enterprise-based labor market. So he never made it. We kind of lost touch with him. But we do have European comrades who kind of are here already for work, or they immigrated legally or whatever, and they're hanging out with us and so forth. When I look at our stat counter for the website, northwestfront.org, you'd be amazed at the places that we get hits from. I assume most of them are white people, but we've gotten hits from the Congo. We get a lot of hits from China. Either that's the Chinese secret police or Chinese interested in us or whatever. We get hits from all over South America, all over Europe, Australia. We're actually fairly popular, if you want to call it that, in Australia and Sweden, in that we have, comparatively speaking, a large number of listeners among our foreign clientele from those two countries. Swedes especially, because their country is being really, really hammered by this non-white Muslim immigration thing, and the crime is becoming almost intolerable over there. And now, of course, they've got this latest wave. I saw an interesting thing on Drudge Report. A lot of the migrants, as they're called, a lot of these people are like Syrians and North Africans and Muslims. They're demanding to go to, quote-unquote, the Nordics. Germany, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, because they've heard, basically, they've got the best welfare there.
The Nordics have less direct experience with the non-whites, and they're more altruistic than the Southern Europeans.
The Greeks and the Italians won't put up with their crap. Although, I understand Italy is really getting hammered as well. I can see why that is, because Italy is actually the closest part of Europe, geographically speaking, to North Africa. I understand they're getting a lot of problems now because of all the Africans that are coming through Libya. Gaddafi, when he was in power, had a fairly powerful army, and he had border guards, and he didn't want all these niggers tramping through his country, and so he kept them out. And since bright spark that he was, Obama overthrew Gaddafi. Now there's basically no government in Libya, and the mobs are just marching on through. And again, if you're into conspiracy theory, maybe that was the object of the game. And maybe that was why Gaddafi had to go. I've always been kind of puzzled as to why they attacked Gaddafi. Nobody had heard anything out of Gaddafi for 20 years. He'd been a good boy.
Harold, my understanding is that Gaddafi was killed because he was such a popular and successful leader, and Libya was doing very well, and it was a threat to Israel, and this securing the realm plan that was converted into a project for a new American century was based on destroying all those successful and therefore threatening to Israel Arab countries surrounding Israel. So that was just another one on the list of seven that were going to be destroyed in 5 years. That was the plan. And you can see that they're still working on Iraq. That was the first one that was hit. That's what's going on over there. These countries are being destroyed, intentionally destroyed. The intention is not to just put a friendly leader in there. They really are intending to destroy those countries.
Yeah, you're exactly right on that. And the one unpardonable sin that Gaddafi did was he was setting up a gold-backed currency, which the bankers couldn't tolerate at all, so he was slated for removal. But you're right, they want to destabilize the Middle East, and they're going to take out seven countries in, I think, 5 years. Yeah, that's the plan.
What they destabilizing the Middle East, that's making all the invasion of Europe possible with all the so-called migrants, so it's destabilizing Europe as well.
Yes, it is.
Win-win.
Which, again, may be part of the plan.
Yep.
Or a bonus.
I think the bottom line to all this is the eradication of the white race, though. The Zionist big threat is the white race. Well, I know they're no match for them.
Bill White refers to this as one world ruled from Jerusalem. And the first time I came across that was many, many years ago. It was in something like A History of the Jewish People by a Jew named Max Diamond, D-I-M-O-N-T. And it was the first time I ever heard it really openly stated, short of the protocols of the Elders of Zion or whatnot. But he stated that the true goal of the Jewish people was what he referred to as a brotherhood of man, which basically is a one-world empire ruled by the Jews from Jerusalem. That's what the man said. And I have to admit that, like Henry Ford once said of the protocols, they fit in with what's going on. This worldview of this conspiracy to establish this one world empire of Jewish rule fits in with what's going on.
Yes, it does.
We got about 15 more minutes here. We got three of you left. Any other topics you guys want to natter about? Any questions you want to ask about the NF, about anything like that?
On the topic of the European immigration crisis, it seems like the holdout where a lot of Western Europeans would be immigrating would be Eastern Europe, as a lot of them are locking down and using military force to keep out the migrants.
Well, they're trying. Like I say, Hungary built a fence, and the migrants are just cutting the fence. When I came over here, they had a Drudge report. They've actually invaded the railway station in Budapest. They've had to shut down the main station, and they're pulling them off trains, literally off trains, off the top of trains. They had all these allegedly horrifying pictures of Hungarian cops dragging the migrants who were screaming and yelling and holding on to the railroad tracks and all this sort of stuff. And they've got literally mothers holding their children who are trying to stay on the railroad tracks. Yeah, the Hungarians are at least making an effort to keep them out, but it's just not successful, and it's not going to be successful until you start shooting these wogs. And, of course, that is just absolutely, utterly no, 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 no. What kind of country does not use its army to fire on invaders, physical invaders? I don't get that. But then again, we haven't been doing it over here, so, you know.
There's different kinds of war. There's wars with guns and tanks and planes, and the ultimate conclusion is to take possession of the land and the government. They're doing the same thing here, not with guns and planes and tanks, but they're storming across the borders.
Because we're letting them.
Maybe we ought to look inside ourselves and say we're creating this situation by our lack of action, by not doing anything.
I've been saying that for years. The reason that they are coming here and taking what we have is because they know they will not be resisted. They know that we will let them do it. They know perfectly well that if they are arrested and deported, they just caught the bad luck of the draw, they will be back in the United States within 2 days and bebopping down the street in East L.A. or wherever. It's almost like a brief vacation for them, just like prison isn't really a deterrent to niggers. Because they know that they will not be dealt with by force. They know that white America will not draw a line along the Rio Grande and say, you do not cross this line without permission. If you do, you will be shot dead. Now, that would stop it, but of course, we're never going to do that. But, oh, they'd be mean and racist and cruel and, oh.
Let me ask you something, Harold. When I was in the Army, before I went in, I used to think, you got the Army, you got your guns, you got your ammunition. The ammunition is really controlled in the Army. Nobody loads a gun unless somebody gives you an order to load a gun. Just even have your weapon primed. So, what's happening on the border? Who's given the order not to do anything?
The United States government, who signs these men's paychecks. And like good Americans, they do what the boss tells them to do. Because if they don't, they might lose their paychecks and they might lose their money.
That's exactly right. Exactly right.
We can't lose our money, can't lose our precious job. That's what Americans live for. So if the boss tells you, and if you're a Border Patrol agent, to stand aside and let 200 Mexican gang members go by in the night, you do it. During all this business about unaccompanied minors that were supposed to be coming last year, there were stories about the Border Patrol agents running basically daycare centers and changing diapers. Bambinos,
I don't know. I couldn't do it. I'd say, here, take the badge. I'm going home. Don't people think beyond themselves?
Some do.
You got to have community to do that.
Yeah. A lot of white people, I think, put up with it because they are convinced that there is no alternative. They are convinced that nobody is ever, ever going to do anything. They are frankly convinced that they are doomed. I get that a lot. They are not being brought to northwestfront.org. It is never being explained to them or shown to them that someone is resisting, and at least someone does have a plan. This is the crux of our problem. There are millions and millions of people out there who would support this movement, and if we could fire them all up and let them know we're here, we would have, within a week, enough money to buy buildings and hire staff and hire professional organizers and create a proper political movement. But that's not going to happen because we talk only to each other and we all kind of hunker down and cower behind our computers afraid that someone will find out. But that's why. Millions of people would support us, but they just don't know we're here.
You know what I find when I bring up the subject with different people? If I just say something as innocuous as there's a lot of white people moving to the Pacific Northwest. Well, as soon as you mention white people, their eyes kind of glaze over because it's leading into race. Nobody wants to talk about race.
We've been conditioned all our lives not to talk about it.
Yeah, if you know who you are. Like I had a discussion one time with a woman. We were talking about niggers and people invading our country. And she was taking the liberal point of view. And I said, let me ask you something. How do you define yourself? What are you? She goes, well, I'm Catholic. The fact that she was Irish from a big Irish family didn't mean anything to her. It was more important that she be Catholic. So she didn't know who she was. My first impulse, like, who are you? Well, I'm from my parents, German and Swedish. That's my identity. That's my base identity. Most people don't have that. They identified, yeah, I'm a Virginia Tech fan or I'm a Catholic. They don't know who they are. Yeah, I think that's where racial awareness comes from. Once you know who you are, then you're racially aware. And most people that I talk to, they're not even aware.
I don't know, more and more. I think the masses are being made aware by all of this rubbish that's coming down because, especially in the Obama years, the liberals have completely overreached. They've gone berserk on this white privilege nonsense, this Black Lives Matter, where they're running around, all the big fat nigger mamas are running on stage and shaking their booty and yelling and screaming and interrupting people's brunch and blocking traffic. And we're just getting pounded and pounded and pounded and pounded in the media that white people bad, white people have privilege, white people are mean to poor little niggas. And the people who live in ordinary houses and work ordinary jobs when they can get them just know that this isn't true. Nobody believes the media. I think that's one good thing that's come out of all these polls and whatnot about the election. The media's credibility level in most of these big fancy polls is actually less than that of Congress. That's going something. I think out there in white America, first off, there is a general sense of deep malaise. Everybody knows something is wrong. I think more people than we give them credit for have some idea of what that is, but they're leaderless, they're rudderless, they have not been brought to northwestfront.org, they don't know that we're here, they don't know that a hope exists, and so they're just muddling through as best they can. And when they do get involved in something, they go on the internet and they find Stormfront. For many people, that's about as far as it goes. They can't find out about the Northwest Front on Stormfront because we're banned on there. But eventually, one way or the other, they will know. Now, we got a big surge over the summer during this Dylann Roof thing. Most of them, of course, were lefties who followed the Guardian article and the Politico.com article, etc. But a lot of them, I'm sure, came because of Dylann's manifesto, which was published in Drudge. And so I'm noticing a lot more questions and whatnot on the blogs and a lot more emails and a lot more intro requests from basically new people. And I'll get some comment or some email saying, hi, my name is Joe and I just found your site, or I've been watching your site for a couple of months now. In other words, he came to us during the Dylann Roof thing. So we did get a little bit of a positive backwash from that. I suppose every cloud has a silver lining. It's happening. We are getting more people. We're going to be meeting with another prospective migrant on Sunday and his wife. It's happening. It's just too slow. And the balloon might go up before we can get our stuff together.
I think you're going to reach a point where there's going to be a flood, though. Something is going to happen. It's going to wake up a lot of people. Ever heard of the 100th monkey theory where people like-minded genetically, when you reach a critical point where a certain number in the theory, they said 100, when the 100th monkey learns something, it just travels through the whole troop. They all absorb it. Maybe that's what we're in for. Maybe we didn't hit that critical mass yet. When enough people become racially aware, it'll be like a cascade and everybody...
I think we're starting to see a little bit of that effect. Despite my constant bitching and moaning and cursing at you guys, I am basically optimistic. I know it's hard to tell sometimes, but I am. I don't know, maybe it's just a case of we have to have our backs absolutely against the wall before we will finally break with this 2-3 generations of social conditioning telling us that we must not raise our hands to anyone with a dark skin and finally take those 300 million guns out of the closet.
Another factor that I think is very important here is that there are certainly things that are happening that we don't know about because the media is suppressing them so that we don't find out how many people there are out there who, one, agree with us, and two, are taking some kind of action.
Comrades, we've got about 2 more minutes left. Does anybody have any final comments or remarks they want to make, anything like that?
On that topic, actually, as far as media hiding certain news, there was actually a very good example of that a few years back. I believe it was 2013, from a massive race riot in Stockholm, Afghans and Somalis, where it was 2,000 Afghans and Somalis rioting, attacking people, raping people, attacking the firefighters who came to put out the fires they started, and so on and so forth. And it only took 300 Swedish nationalists to break them up, essentially assist police, basically scatter the rabble, and that's 7-1 odds.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's impressive.
And it was not covered whatsoever. The media was absolutely silent, besides the few reports. They did not let that go international whatsoever. But you can look it up, the Stockholm race riots. Like I said, I believe it was 2013.
Right. You constantly hear all this rumor about stuff going on here, stuff going on there. Again, it's very hard to know how much of it is true and how much of it is just basically internet buzz. This is a huge country, and I imagine that every day, all over, from sea to shining sea, there are things going on that just would blow the mind. Okay, anything else, guys?
Just one comment. Just what you said. I have a view of what's going on in Europe. How would you like to be in Europe, where you've got these, as you said before, they're storming across the borders, fighting to get into the cities, and you have no self-defense, you've got nowhere to run. At least over here, we've got a place to run, and we can defend ourselves.
Well, I suppose it's always possible that something might snap in the European consciousness, and all of a sudden, the white people over there will remember who they are. I hope. Either that, or it's also possible, I think, that some of the European governments may just decide, look, screw the plan. We can't take this. The lifeboat is full. Like, especially in Britain. My God, I don't know how anyone can even think of jamming any more people into that tiny little island. And I don't want to think about what's happening in Ireland.
Harold, can I make one comment that's relevant to what you're talking about, both of you are talking about?
Okay.
And that is, Angela Merkel, several months ago, maybe a year ago, made a public statement that multiculturalism is not working. From her point of view, these people are not adopting the European culture. Now, she would not say that multiracialism is not working. What she said was multiculturalism is not working. So she's not willing to go all the way to address the heart of the problem. But among the political leadership in Europe, the idea that multiculturalism is failing is widespread. Now, they just don't know what to do about it because they cannot, in their minds, take the next step and say it's multiracialism that's not working.
Every time I see Angela Merkel and Vladimir Putin talking, my imagination starts to wander.
Okay, guys, that's going to be about it for this evening. Thanks for calling. We will get this together, and I think we've actually got something that can be put up as a separate podcast this time.
Thanks, Harold.
Okay, all right.
David, good one.
Okay.
Goodbye, everybody.
Good night.